But for the purposes of learning and memory, we try to reduce the number as much as possible and then learn a few rules that handle the minor modifications. Do you need to make some adjustments?
Sure. Is this turning the Bible or?
This is Greek.
Greek too. Okay. They had the ellipsis for both, right?
Yeah, you have to be fast to do that. But charting the Bible is not a discussion hour right now. So the only hours we need in charting the Bible are from Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 11 for a tape. The rest of it we don't need tape because it's just a research hour. So, yeah, but this one definitely does need some tape. Good. Thank you. So, the main purpose for a deflection is just to try to help categorizing things in the deflection, just to help our memory and to help us to begin to see patterns and try to reduce the memory load as much as possible, workload as much as possible. Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Now, he mentions here dictionary forms. For nouns, at least, the dictionary form is the nominative singular form. And I think you're aware, too, of the fact that also, what other piece of information is normally included in the dictionary form? When you look at it, when you look up on it now, yeah, the genitive, yeah, the gender is in. How is the gender indicated? We're getting a little ahead of ourselves. By the article, that's the only reliable means you have for telling what the gender is on a noun, and we'll get into that next chapter. What other piece of information is usually contained after the noun to give you some more information as far as declension is concerned? Genitive singular form. And the reason for that, of course, is that you can't, in many cases, absolutely determine the declension without that piece of information. Because in some cases, the nominative forms are going to be the same for different declensions. You know, you've got your eta sigmas on some of your third declension nouns and also on your first declension masculine nouns, that type of thing. And so in order to tell exactly what declension it is, that genitive form is there also. When you first get started, it's not much problem. If you're only dealing with first and second declension, you can usually tell. But once you get those third declension ones in, now you need that piece of information on the genitive form. So all of that is there to try to give you, at a quick glance, all the information you need to make the full paradigm of that noun. So if you know the article, you know what the gender is. If you know the dictionary form of the word, you'll have most of the information you need. Then with the addition of the genitive form, you have all the information you need to really fill out the paradigm. Assuming, of course, you know the paradigms for first, second, third declension. And as you well know, third declension is by far the more difficult of those, just because of the complications that arise from the type of endings that you're putting on. Okay, now, chapter 6, nouns, gender, the definite article. He first discusses this concept of genders and makes mention of the fact in the first section that its main function grammatically is in the area of concord or agreement. That's your main grammatical function for the concept of gender. It helps you to put words together. It helps you to see which words are going with other words. And if you've got a masculine noun and you've got a masculine adjective that's modifying it, so you can see that that adjective modifies that noun and not something else. When you get to relative pronouns and so forth, again, it's very useful in telling you what the antecedent of your relative pronoun is. So, and it's especially important there because it's about the only device you really got, because the case isn't going to necessarily line up because it's functioning differently in its clause. So your gender is the thing that's your primary device there for linking things together. Now, he mentions the genders, masculine, feminine, and neuter, so we have three categories here. And then he makes special emphasis on the fact that this does not correspond to sexual distinction. There isn't any implied masculinity or femininity in the way we normally associate with male and female by these grammatical distinctions. They're purely and simply grammatical distinctions, and the labels that are attached to them could have been any other labels. You know, you could have, you know, you could use, you know, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry if you wanted, you know. That's kind of what modern physicists are getting to with labeling different particles. But the point is, you could come up with almost anything, although because there does seem to be a relatively consistent lineup of masculine ending forms when you are dealing with, like, males versus females, then it serves to use that distinction to label everything else once you see the pattern. So there is a general correlation when you're dealing with nouns that are dealing with people and dealing with masculinity and femininity. However, even there, it's not always the case. For example, you get a few examples. Corazione, for example, which is actually neuter, but refers to little girl, or Paidarion, which means little boy. Both of them actually neuter in gender as far as the nouns are concerned. And parts of the body and so forth, care, kephale, daster, all of them are feminine in gender, regardless of whether it's referring to a man's stomach or a woman's stomach, you see. And so there's other parts of the body are masculine, you see. So it's not necessarily lining up along any other distinctions once you leave the realm of dealing with actual people. Okay. All familiar with that, I think. Then he comes to discussion of the real introductory discussion of the article. And down there in section 39, well, first in 38, he talks about the fact that it's the article that you need to really tell what the gender of a noun is. You can't really, you can't go by the endings, because the endings really only tell you something about the declension. And while it's true that, most of your second declension nouns are going to be masculine or neuter. There's very few feminine second declension nouns. There are some. And most of your first declension nouns are going to be feminine, but there are some masculine ones. So because of that fact, you can't go just by the declension and by the ending of the noun. You've got to have some other information that will unambiguously give you the gender. And the only thing that is available to do that is the article, which means then that if you're going to fully know a vocabulary word and a noun, you're going to need to know the form of the article that's associated with it. So this is why in the dictionaries and in the vocabs we learn the article with the noun. It's simply because we want to be able to identify the gender of the noun in an unambiguous fashion. So he mentions a little bit about the article. This is one area we're going to spend a lot more time with this year on the definite article, looking into a lot more detail as far as its meaning and so forth is concerned. So far we've just kind of gotten the idea that it's somewhat analogous to the English definite article. We recognize there's no indefinite article in Greek, so we see a little bit of difference, but we haven't really gone into much detail with that. We will be doing much more with that a little bit later on this year. We see that the article, just like any other adjective, will agree with the noun that it's modifying in case, number, and gender, so it's going to take a form that's going to agree with its noun. And we have a short partial paradigm for the article here in section 39, top of page 35. And the article masculine, article whole for the masculine singular nominative, tone for the accusative singular nominative, accusative singular, excuse me, masculine, the plural nominative, boy, and the accusative, tous, and then for the feminines, hey, tame, high, and tot. Nouns of neuter gender, however, have behaved differently from those of masculine and feminine genders. And we have the same article. If we first get introduced to the fact that the neuters don't have a distinction in forms in the nominative and accusative, and that situation holds throughout all of the paradigms, throughout all of the declensions, and your third declensions and so forth as well. Neuters don't make any distinction between accusative and nominative forms, which can sometimes generate some ambiguities. Usually, context is sufficient to resolve the situation, but there are some times where there may be some problem. Okay, so he gives a full, or a little fuller paradigm down here. We still don't have genitive or dative forms. Section 40 there, generally speaking, when rendering the Greek and English, Greek articles should be translated by the, and rendering the English to Greek, the should be translated by some form of the Greek article. So he's just kind of giving a rough rule of thumb that corresponds to where you put the word the in English. But that's not going to necessarily hold in every instance, as we'll see later on when we get into this. He mentions exceptions and so forth. Then we see the terms anarthrous and articular. Anarthrous just meant simply meaning no article, and articular having the article. It's straightforward. And on page 36 here, we begin to see even a little bit fuller paradigm now with the article and its noun. The first here holds theos, shon theon, hoi theoi, tous theus. We find the second declension. Then we find a feminine, he teme, the first declension. With the ada type endings, so hey to me, tain to mean, hi to my, tas to mas, neuter, to technon, ta techna, ta techna. No distinction between between nominative and accusative. He mentions here too that the endings of articles very frequently rhyme, or nearly rhyme, with the endings of the noun as they do above. However, this is not necessarily the case. And it works better if you're only dealing with second and first declension, because the paradigm of the article is somewhat like first declension in the feminine and second declension in the masculine and neuter. And it's not at all like third declension. So once you get to third declension, they hardly ever rhyme. But he says, however, this is not necessarily the case. Many feminine nouns in the first declension have alpha instead of eta and eta nu, so there'll be a breakdown in rhyme right there. The article will always have etas, but a first declension noun, depending on the ending of the stem, will either have etas or alphas. When do we get alphas? What's the criterion for the stem when you get alpha type? Row or vowel, right. If the stem ends in a row or a vowel, then you're going to get the alpha types. And then there's a certain oddball class of first declensions that get alphas in the nominative and accusative form and go back to etas in the dative form and dative and genitive. And that's like glossa here, these some other kinds, as he calls them, I guess, or a few other nouns or whatever. So we get a kind of a mixed paradigm there. We don't really know about the mixing yet because we haven't seen the genitive and dative as far as the book is concerned at this point. Okay. Is there any other question on this much of the paradigm to this point as far as review is concerned? Notice he mentions here in section 44, most masculine nouns of the first declension are declined like mate tase below, and feminine nouns of the second declension are declined exactly like masculine nouns of the second declension. So we have first declension masculine nouns whose paradigm differs slightly. The main feature here up to this point is ho mate tase. Instead of mate te, like you might expect on the analogy of time, you do have a sigma on the nominative form in your first declension masculines. You'll also notice later on that the genitive form goes to an omicron upsilon just like the second declension. So it's kind of a mix a little bit. But it's called first declension because the majority of the forms line up with the first declension forms. The second declension feminines, however, they're just exactly like the second declension masculines. And there's no difference there at all except for the fact that the article is different. So it's hey ho dos instead of ho ho dos, for example. Okay. And neuter nouns like totectone are assigned to the second declension. At this point, it may seem... You wonder, well, why? They don't. Neither one of the endings look like the masculine second declension ones. But when we get to the dative and the genitive, the endings are the same as the masculine ones, and that's why they're lumped into that category. That's why I said a person could even consider the neuters a separate declension, you know, and you could come up with all kinds of them, but I think that would intimidate the students even more than they already are. If you had to learn 10 declensions, well, it would be... But in fact, you have learned about that many, but... You know, we won't really tell you that so that you don't get scared off. Okay, subject and object, chapter 7. Any other questions here? Okay, we're introduced to the idea of subject and object, something that you should have at least some knowledge from English about. And again, the procedure is to compare English with Greek, first talking about English, and he lists a number of sentence types here that he'll be drawing upon later on. And in all of these sentence types, the subject of the sentence is in boldface type here. We've seen many different types of sentences. Sentences with simple subject and object type of construction. Sentences with a subject and then an adverbial modifier with no object. Predicate nominative type constructions, etc., etc. So we won't get into all the details of that now, but the main point is just to indicate here that as far as English is concerned, it's the position of the word in the sentence that determines whether it's a subject. Since English doesn't have declensions and case functions and so forth, it's the position in the sentence that is the primary criterion. And the meaning of the subject of the sentence gets a little bit nebulous too, because if we simply define it as the performer of the action, we can get into trouble when we get into a passive sentence construction. Because then with a passive verb, the subject is now the receiver of the action. So it doesn't do a whole lot of good to define it as the performer of the action, because you get in trouble in the other thing, unless you make a split definition or something. Say with active verbs it's the performer of the action, with passive verbs it's the receiver of the action or something like that, I suppose you could do. But he kind of shies away from that and tries to look at the subject as occupying a certain position in the sentence as far as English is concerned. But going to Greek, we have in some ways things are a little bit easier. because we're not so dependent upon word order now. We've got a far less ambiguous system, and that is an actual case ending. So section 48, this phrase in italics here is the general rule. The subject of a sentence in Greek is normally indicated by a noun or pronoun in the nominative case. Conversely, the principal function of the nominative case is to indicate the subject of a sentence. So that's the way we associate nominative case, subject of the sentence. And that doesn't necessarily mean either performer of the action or receiver of the action. That'll depend on the nature of the verb. But it is the subject of the sentence. And it's not the only function of the nominative case. We're going to run into one a little bit later on. We have a predicate nominative construction in which you have two things that are in the nominative case that are being equated together. So, and there are some other things like nominative absolutes and so forth that we haven't gotten to yet where the nominative case will be used. But by and large, the vast, overwhelming majority of cases in which you see the nominative case used is because it's denoting the subject of the sentence. So that's your general rule. Then as far as objects are concerned, again in English, the object is determined by word order. And it's positioned in the sentence structure, largely designated by word order. And here we find this example, the dog bit the man. If you reverse man and dog in the sentence, you have a different sentence, the man bit the dog. So you've got a completely different sentence without changing any of the actual words, just reversing word order. And so it's indicating that this is the chief grammatical device in English for designating subject and object. In Greek, of course, the object also would be indicated by a different case ending, in this case, the accusative. And so in Greek, the direct object is not indicated by position or word order, but by its case, which is in most instances is the accusative case. And he says most instances because there are certain verbs that will take a genitive for an object or a dative, or you know, just be because of the nature of the verb, especially ones that have prepositions associated with them and so forth. And we'll be looking at a chapter that will deal with some of those a little bit later on, too. We haven't got to it yet. He mentions that it should be noted that, however, that not all sentences contain direct objects. Some of them just don't have one. And so there may not be an accusative at all in the sentence. In other words, in a Greek sentence, you may not, it's not a requirement to have something in the accusative case. But normally, I mean, the most common types of sentences will have something in the accusative case. But he gives the general rule here again, aside from the exceptions and so forth. The direct object in a sentence in Greek is normally indicated by a noun or pronoun in the accusative case. Conversely, one of the principal functions of the accusative case is to indicate the direct object in a sentence. Can you think of any other functions of an accusative case that you know of?
Object complement.
Okay, object complement is another one where you had this kind of, this situation where the captain called the mate a fool or something, the mate called the captain a fool type of situation. You have an object complement. Any others? Right. For infinitives, you have the subject will be an accusative case for infinitive construction. Good. There's another one. Any others? Yes. Prepositional phrases. That's probably one of the most common ones you'll see. It's prepositions. A number of prepositions take govern the accusative. So you'll see lots of accusatives as a result of objects and prepositions. And then there's the double accusatives, too. So there's the object complement, and there's something analogous with a double accusative, where verbs like to ask and so forth. You can ask somebody something, and you'll have an accusative of the somebody you're asking and an accusative of the something you're asking. So there's quite a few functions for the accusative case, aside from this one. But this is the most important one, the one that first comes to mind, the one that we want to deal with most basically. Okay? But all of those other functions of the accusative case are analogous to this one. I mean, it's not like they're something completely different. I suppose the most different one probably would be the subject of infinitive being an accusative case. But even there, as you analyze the whole kind of construction that's involved, there's reason for that. It's something maybe we'll try to take a closer look at when we do some diagramming. Okay. Then he gives us a comparison of Greek and English sentences. Six sets of sentences here, and I won't go into detail and read all of these, but you'll notice, though, that if you look in the right-hand column and see the English, you'll see subject, S, V, and O, subject, verb, object, in all of these sentences in that order, subject first, then verb, then object. So all six of those sentences, dealing with completely different things, have the same structural word order. On the other hand, if you look at the Greek side here, you'll see every permutation of order here. Subject, verb, object, subject, object, verb, verb, subject, object, verb, object, subject, object, verb, subject, and object, subject, verb. In other words, The Greek word order is going to be all over the map. And these are all examples taken out of the scriptures. So you can see that there are actual usages in the text where all of these combinations of word order are possible. And again, emphasis and so forth, things like that will often determine the actual word order in a given situation. Then we talk a little bit in the next part about transitive verbs and just looking at the basic pattern here. Noun 1, verbs, noun 2 is the basic pattern in the English. And we have one noun that's followed by a verb and then another noun. The first noun is the subject, the second noun is the direct object. Although there are some other sentence types that may have noun 1, verb, noun 2, and the noun 2 may not be the direct object, it may be a predicate nominative or something. That's why he's using the kind of a generalized form here first, and then specializes that a little bit later on. And so a specialized form would be as subject, verb, object. But this noun 1, verb, noun 2 pattern can also be seen with some other sentence types as well, which you wouldn't say subject, verb, object. So trying to keep a real general picture there. Transitive verb is defined in the footnote here as one which has both active and passive forms. And that's tantamount to saying it's a verb that can take an object. You see, but to say that a verb can take passive forms is really pretty much the same as saying that the verb can take a direct object. Because of what is a passive form? A passive form is a form of the verb whereby you take the thing that was the direct object and make that the new subject and use a passive verb form. If something cannot take a direct object, obviously it can't have a passive verb form. And if something has no passive verb form, period, then it's not going to be the verb that's going to be able to take an object. So that's an interesting way to define it here, but it really is pretty much the same as saying that it can't take an object. And you get some examples here. The tenant rented the house. The house was rented by the tenant. So you have both active and passive forms there, and that is a transitive verb. But the collie came home, but not the home was come by the collie. You know, it's that verb isn't normally considered a transitive verb unless you're trying to be funny or something, I suppose. Okay. The rest of this, I don't know if we want to spend too much time with. He's just saying here, as far as section 51 is concerned, that in Greek, instead of saying noun 1, verb noun 2, we would say noun in the nominative, noun n sub n, and noun in the accusative, to indicate that, because the word order is going to vary. And so we don't want to use 1 and 2 there, because that implies an order. We want to use nominative and accusative, because in Greek it's the cases that are determining that. Yes? Right.
That's not the same as the transitive example, because home is not the noun.
Well, you got a good point there.
You could say, the collie came to the home.
Uh-huh.
Then you could say, the home was come to by the collie.
Right. Yeah, I think you got a good point there. As far as that home is concerned, that probably would be considered technically an adverb in this case. That kind of gets into a fuzzy area in English. In English. Yeah. You can't really make an adverb a subject, but that's it. And just to substitute a raw noun there, it doesn't seem to work anymore. So that's a good point. Because see what's... we might say the home... Yeah, if you use the article on it, the home was come to by the collie. But still, what it is, I think what his point is that we don't normally... Something was come to. I've heard it. You know, heard people say it. Maybe it's just a violation of Greek of English grammar. But I don't know. You know, it's like the use of the word ain't or something. You know, for a while they used to tell us it's all wrong, and then when people started doing it, you know, they kept doing it and doing it and doing it, I think somebody finally put it in the dictionary or something. I don't know if they've done it with that one yet or not.
What is the function of the two?
That would be a prepositional phrase indicating in English. Now, in some cases, it might be an indirect object, but in case of to the home or something where there's motion, that would be just a prepositional phrase in English, an adverbial prepositional phrase. Huh? Well, it turns into a dangling preposition. That's something that you're not supposed to do in English, to leave a preposition hanging on the end of a word. And It just gets into very awkward English. You know, it's like the house was come into or something, or the house was broken. Well, yeah, the house was broken into. We do it a lot. But, you know, you always hear, and you always get red marks in your paper for leaving them dangling there. Huh? Yeah, I don't think it is. I don't think it's really rigorously proper. I don't know. Mark may know something more about how loose things have gotten now, but I can remember always getting chastened in English classes for doing things like that. Yeah, right. And see, home, the problem is the home is an adverb in this first construction. See, the first one, when it says the collie came home, that is not a direct object. Home would not be analyzed as a direct object there because it is an intransitive verb. And it's just a place, it's an adverb of place. And although you could say the collie came to the house, but now you've got a prepositional phrase. And that's an adverbial prepositional phrase. It's not a direct object. In other words, this verb come doesn't take a direct object. That's what our real problem is. And so it is a valid example in that respect, but he's just showing you how awkward that thing sounds when you reverse it. And that just fortifies the fact that home in this case is not a direct object. Yes?
Is there a form like this in Greek that we're just talking about English here?
We're just talking about English here in this case. But in Greek, you're going to see similar situations. You're going to see there are intransitive verbs in Greek as well, and to come would be one of those. And so it's pretty much analogous in the Greek in this particular instance too. You're going to see verbs that don't have a passive form, although sometimes you do see verbs having a middle form and no passive form because they've got kind of number of verbs in Greek that don't have any passive form. There are other verbs in Greek that have passive forms but no active forms, and the passive form goes deponent verbs, remember. And so there are lots of verbs that don't have the full paradigm, just like in English. Okay, anyone else? Question on that? That may not be the best example as far as colleague, somebody maybe come up with a better one, but it illustrates what we're saying. Okay, other sentence types in chapter 8. He first deals with, he mentions the subject verb object type, and then he talks about sentence number 2 in that list of, in section 45 that he had. The judge coughed apologetically. Here we have a subject verb adverb construction. So now we don't have a direct object, but we have an adverb, and that's a pretty common sentence type as well. And he doesn't spend a lot of time with that. There's a few examples here in the Greek in section 54 in which you have a subject-verb type of construction, and none of these really have adverbs. It's just a subject-verb, basically. So you can just have subject-verb or subject-verb-adverb, the adverb kind of being optional element to it, and that's another very common sentence type. You don't necessarily have to have a direct object. Then he gets into section 55, spends a little more time with this type of sentence. And that is, his wife is a vegetarian, as an example in English. There you have noun one, verb noun two. Looks on the surface the same, like the same pattern as that first sentence, subject, verb, object. But it is not subject, verb, object in the same sense that we've seen before. What we have instead is the verb in this case is not indicating a performance of an action. To be something isn't really an action. And so rather, the verb is indicating something that is identified rather than something that an action that's being performed. And so there's a special category for this kind of verb. They're called equative verbs. They're very rare, about the only two that we ever really deal with to any extent, both in English and in Greek, are the verbs to be and to become. And so in English, to be and to become, in Greek, eimi and ginomai, are your two most common and almost exclusive equative verbs. And so he gives us some more examples here in making a distinction here between his wife is a vegetarian, his wife became a vegetarian, his wife saw a vegetarian, his wife shot a vegetarian. Okay. We have equative verbs in the first two examples, is and became. And became is still an equative verb, but it indicates a process. Still, one thing is being characterized by another thing. And then his wife saw a vegetarian, there you see a transitive verb, and the vegetarian would be a direct object. His wife shot a vegetarian, of course, is obviously a transitive verb, and action's being performed and being received on the other end. Okay? Now, then he mentions, of course, the two most important equative verbs. Now, the interesting thing, though, for our purposes, is that in Greek, this kind of a sentence structure, in English, it looks pretty much the same as a subject-verb-object thing. The only thing that tips us off is the fact that the verb is equative. That's the only tip-off that we have, that we're looking at a different type of structure. In Greek, however, we have another tip-off. We have another piece of information that can tell us we're dealing with a predicate kind of construction. And in fact, if we run across some verb that we have never seen before, and we see two nominatives in the sentence, we can infer that verb has an equative function by the fact that two nominatives are used. So I don't know of any other verbs besides me and ginomai that are equative. There might be some with some prepositional attachments to either one of those. That's probably the only ones I can think of. But the point is that in Greek, in addition to having an equative verb, you have both of the nouns in the nominative case. And that will really help you identify very clearly exactly what's going on. And it's a very powerful device. But that introduces a certain ambiguity now. And what ambiguity would that be if you've got two things in the nominative case? Right. Which one is the subject? If they're both in the nominative case, how do we determine which one's the subject of the sentence and which one's the predicate nominative? Well, it may not be a gigantic problem just because the two are being equated. Whichever one you start out with and call the subject is being equated to the other. However, very often there is a distinction in the way those things need to be rendered. And in John 1, for example, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was toward God, etc., and the Word was God, it does make a difference as to, in the phrase, the Word was God, which one you call the predicate nominative and which one you call the subject. And so the question is, how do we determine that as far as Greek is concerned? And there are five criteria that are given. The essential idea is definiteness. So the basic underlying thing is that the thing that's the more definite of the two is going to be the subject. And the thing that's the more general of the two will be the predicate nominative. And that just stands to reason. You're focusing on the more definite thing, and then you're characterizing the more definite thing by a broader category. And so, regardless of word order now, of course, remember in Greek, it's not the word order that's going to be the determining factor. And so you may have two nominatives in the sentence, and it's not a matter of just saying, well, here's the first one, that must be the subject. It doesn't work that way in Greek. You have to decide which is the more definite of the two, which is the more specific. And five criteria are given here for doing that. Criteria A, if one of the two nouns is a proper name, it is a subject. Why? Because obviously a proper name is very specific. When you use a proper name, you're talking about a very specific individual. And so that would be the obvious thing to point out as being the subject. So here in the sentence, Barabbas was a robber. Barabbas would be the obvious one. Barabbas in the Greek would be a very clear indication of that. The second criteria, if only one of the nouns has the article, it is the subject. So if you have a situation where one of the nouns has the article and the other one doesn't, then that's going to be obviously the one that's the more definite, and that will be considered the subject. Then see if both nouns are equally definite or indefinite. In other words, if they both got the article and they both don't have the article, then the one that has the narrower reference is the subject. And he gives an example here that I would reverse. He says, he hamartia est in he anomia, says sin is lawlessness, and he calls sin the narrower reference. Lawlessness the more broad category. I would reverse that and say lawlessness is sin, and call sin the broader category. because it's just the way it's used. That this is debatable. In other words, when you deal with a criteria like this, you can get into some debate, because one guy will say this is more broad than this one. This is probably the most difficult of all of them to really nail down. It's going to just, you know, you're often going to have to rely on the context there to see what the train of thought has been and what is being characterized as what. And you know, in his view, he may be saying that the real subject matter there is sin, and they're trying to characterize sin and tell you what sin is like. And in his mind, he might be saying, well, in this particular passage, you know, he may not be saying that it's always that way, but says there are other kinds of lawlessness besides sin. I would say there are other kinds of sin besides lawlessness. I'd reverse it completely there. Maybe it was a typographical error, I don't know. But be that as it may, the principle is that the one that's the more definite of the two, the one that has the narrower reference, is going to be the subject. Then the category D, if one of two nouns has been referred to in the immediately preceding context, it's the subject. Of course, again, the idea there being that if it's been referred to in the immediately preceding context, it's been the subject of the discussion. It's the thing you've been talking about. And now you're introducing some new information. You're characterizing what you've been talking about in a certain particular fashion, and that, of course, would dictate that the thing you have been talking about would be your subject. Then the final category, if an equative verb joins a noun to a pronoun, the pronoun is the subject. Why would we say the pronoun would have to be the subject in this instance? Why would that be more definite? Yes? Right. Good point. The point is that if you're able to use a pronoun, pronoun is a word that stands for some other word. And the only way you can get away with using a pronoun is to have a context that people know you're talking about something specific. And therefore, a pronoun would be an indicator of something very definite in the context. Okay, good. All right. Yes, Eric? In effect, it does. To have a pronoun, it very much does function that way. It's almost as though when you say he, and you're talking about the one that I've been talking about, it's got a very definite kind of concept to it. That's a real good point. Yes, Rob?
You pointed that out.
Yes. Yes. Yes, it is. It is important, especially in things like John 1:1, to point out the use of the article, theos and so forth, in the second passage, in the second part of the phrase, and theos without the article in the first. And you're dealing with predicate constructions in both cases. And, well, the first one is not really a predicate, it's kind of an existential type of thing. In the beginning was the Logos. But then when it says in the Logos was, God was the Logos, actually. It's whole theos. You see, that's going to be your subject. God was the Logos. And in that instance, you almost have two different things going here, because one person might say, well, Logos must be the subject because it was referred to previously. In the beginning was the Logos, you know, and the Logos was proston theon, was toward the God, and the Logos was God. I've got something reversed there. The last part of the phrase has no article on God. And that kind of leaves you in that position where which one is the subject. But whole Logos, you see, Logos had the article and God didn't in the last phrase. God had an article earlier as a object of a prepositional phrase, and you're really left with no choice on that. I mean, there's just no way out of it. It's Logos was the subject and God was the predicate nominative. And that makes quite a difference theologically there, because if you say God is the Logos, you would be identifying, or if you had articles on both of them, you'd be identifying the two almost totally completely and making one term synonymous with the other. And that's not what he's trying to say. So it really stands out. And it's interesting that once you have been exposed enough to Greek, and not only just learning these rules, but seeing them in action, and that's what we're going to be doing a lot this semester, you will develop a feeling for this that is really important, I think. We don't go by feelings, obviously, but what I'm talking about is really getting into the Greek way of thinking, so that when you see an article, certain information is being transmitted to your mind even without even thinking about it. When you see no article, certain information is transmitted to your mind. And it's not always going to be real easy to describe the difference in real simple terms. There will be a distinction that you will sense. And so we want to keep, you know, this is one of the main reasons for the second year, is to cultivate that kind of thing and enable us to do that. Okay. This last section here, section 59, should be particularly noticed that when the predicate nominative precedes the verb in Greek, it generally does not have the article. Since this is true, it is frequently necessary to supply a definite article in English, even though there's none in Greek. This is one of those areas that I think is worthy of some study. It's a conclusion that may be all right, but here he gives an example, "Houtos ho anthropos huios theouein." This man was the son of God. And because huios here has no article, but it precedes the verb is last here in this sentence, ein, he's saying that it could be rendered, "This man was the son of God," even though the article's not on there. And that's the kind of thing that may be debatable. So I'll just kind of leave a question mark on that for you. Maybe somebody wants to do a research. You know, you could do your research paper on that, see what you come up with. Check Robertson and some of the other sources on this, too. Yes?
It seems to be a legitimate statement, though, that it generally does not have the article.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the lines of interpretation of speech on the previous page in his line? Because what he calls the subject has the article preceding the verb. So if, like you say, lawlessness is sin,
mm-hmm.
then therefore, according to a general rule in Greek, then
hamartia
should be an article.
Yes. The point there, though, is we do have articles on both of them, and that's a little bit different situation. In other words, you, in order to have this section 59 situation apply, I see what you're saying is that it normally wouldn't need the article, and the fact that the article is there is calling more attention to the definiteness of the thing. That's something that somebody may want to pursue as a thesis. This situation in section 59 doesn't happen very often, so we may just have to have somebody grind it out and see if is there really some validity to this. I'm not saying throw it out. I'm just saying question it a little bit. Because I've learned to be suspicious of some of these things, because oftentimes when you trace it back to its origin, there's a certain doctrine, theological doctrine, that has to be upheld by its doing this. And so in this example, it may be okay. It may be saying this man was the son of God rather than this man was a son of God. But you wonder, you know, maybe he really did say this man was a son of God. Maybe that's what the centurion, I think that's what the reference was here, is when the centurion was, you know, observing the crucifixion of Christ. You wonder, you know, what was that Roman centurion's concept? It's like Nebuchadnezzar seeing the fourth man in a fiery furnace, you know. So, in other words, I don't think this passage could be used as a proof text for this idea by itself. We'll have to look at a number of other situations and see if there's a consistent pattern there. So, maybe we ought to take note of that. It would really be good, I think, for somebody to do a research on that and see if he could. That would be work, though, because this kind of thing, to find the scriptures that have an anarthrous noun before the verb, is going to involve a scanning of the whole New Testament here to pick them out. I don't know how else you would do it. So if anybody really wants to. We need Jim Blanchard's program for that. That would really be a trick to program it to pick out those. Okay. Adjectives, section 9, chapter 9. This is where the plot begins to thicken a little bit. Not that an adjective itself is all that difficult, but with adjectives you're combining a lot of information you've had before. You've got to be concerned not only about the paradigms and the forms of them, but you also have the fact that a given adjective can be attached to any kind of noun, and therefore it's going to have to be able to be declined into all three genders. So with adjectives, you have not only case and number to be concerned about, but also gender. In other words, a given adjective will appear in all three genders, whereas a given noun will only appear in one gender, one of the three. Its gender is fixed, whereas an adjective's gender is going to be in concord with its noun. So the paradigm, a full paradigm for an adjective, is going to be rather large in most cases, because you've got both masculine, feminine, and neuter forms. All three to consider. Also, with adjectives, we have position of the adjective to be concerned about, and the fact that the position of the adjective is associated with the kind of meaning that it has. And of course, you remember the predicate positions and the attributive positions for the adjective. So he gets in first of all to talking about what an adjective is in English, He starts out with a syntactic type of definition where an adjective is what fits into these positions type of thing. And his first examples here, hot water dissolves sugar quickly, hostile savages capture the missionaries, and so forth. And then with an article, a hot cup of tea, or a hostile environment, etc. And then he uses some equative verb examples. The weather is hot, his attitude was hostile, or you have an equative verb to be preceding the adjective. And the adjective is now being kind of separated off, not directly associated with the word that it's modifying, but is kind of being singled out and pointed to, and the actual state of things is being, the attention is being drawn to that rather than kind of assumed, you see. When you talk about the hot water and you're talking about something else over here, that it did, the hot water burned the man's skin or something like that, your focus is, hot is something you're just attributing to the water and you're talking about something else. But you say the water is hot, is drawing all of your attention upon that attribute, and so you have a slightly different situation there and a different emphasis. And that's the basic distinction that we see also in Greek, that those first sets there, hot water, hostile savages, etc., would be called attributive positions, where the adjective is modifying the noun and is pretty much functioning together as a unit with the noun in the sentence structure. So the adjective is kind of tied onto the noun and the whole unit is functioning as something else in the sentence structure. Whereas in a predicate position, all the attention is being drawn to the comparison and to that modification, you might say, of the noun. And there's a statement of that attribute, you might say, and that's what we would call a predicate position. Okay, moving to... Well, he gets into a little bit of discussion of the idea of a substantive and so forth, a few things here too, and the fact that there are certain words that modify other nouns but are not technically adjectives. In other words, where you can take a noun, the appointments committee, for example, where you can take another noun and use it like an adjective to modify another noun. We'll see that happen in Greek also. But then he talks about substantives in section 62. He has put down the mighty from their seat, taking an adjective and making it function like a noun. And that's something that will also happen in Greek. A word that's an adjective can be used as if it were a noun, and it's called a substantive. And it's very interesting that when you get right down to the bottom line, it's oftentimes, if you're really pressed, it's oftentimes difficult to really prove whether what you're looking at is really an adjective that's being used as a substantive, or just a pure old adjective by itself, or it gets into a kind of a gray area sometimes. And kind of just depends on how the word is normally used and how it's commonly used, and you kind of have to look at it from that perspective. But you do get into a very interesting situation there. It's like in the situation where you have monogenes theos. There's a debate as to whether monogenes is an adjective modifying theos, in which case you'd have this problem of having God being only begotten, if you take it the way that some take it. Monogenes doesn't really mean only begotten, but that's the way it's often taken. And then you'd have the problem of God being begotten. Or whether monogenes is not an adjective modifying theos, but is in fact a substantive in apposition to theos. In which case you would not be having theos being monogenes. You would have someone you're describing who is monogenes, comma, theos. He is only begotten and he's theos. And you no longer have this modification element to it. So you get into some very fine and very interesting situation sometimes when you deal with this question of substantive versus an attributive adjective. Yes? No, usually the article will pretty much solve it, because that will remove the apposition sense. You see, if two things are in apposition, if they both have the article, you'll see the article on one and then the article repeated on the other, and they'll just be put together. But if you have the article, of course, that makes it now attributive. It puts it into an attributive position. So the reason that monogenes theos is ambiguous is because there is no article. And now you have the question of whether it's two things in apposition or one thing modifying another. But you're right, with the article, that would resolve it. Well, I think in that it's mainly just how they're rendering it in English, I suppose. It's with the article on it, they're obviously, in either case, recognizing it as a substantive. To put the article on that and make it on an adjective, what we normally saw as an adjective and have it stand together, whole phoneros, you see, that's going to be, half. That's going to have to be, and to have that the subject of a sentence and so forth, that's going to have to be rendered a noun as far as its function is concerned. So just to say the evil or the evil one, I suppose the difference may have to do with the way the person is conceiving of the thing, whether he's personifying it or not. In other words, to say the evil, it's still a fully justifiable substantive, but it might be the evil thing. However, there's one thing that needs to be mentioned here, that if it's the evil thing, you're more likely to see a neuter type of form. In other words, see, poneros is an adjective, so it can be either masculine, feminine, or neuter. And then to put the article on it, you know, if you wanted to say the evil thing, you'd most likely use the neuter article in the neuter form. If you want to say an evil person, if it was an evil man, you would use the masculine. If it was an evil woman, if it was Jezebel or something like that you're talking about in the context, then you might have hey poneros. Okay, that's all for today. We'll move on to the next time. Review. Yes, you're almost forced in a situation like that where you have those kinds of ambiguities. You have to say, how does the rest of the scripture fit this? And so you've got to consider those things because you don't really have anything else to go by there. And of course, Trinitarians might go a different direction than we would on that. You'll never get free of your need to examine parallel passages, no matter how much Greek or Hebrew you know. You've got to let Scripture interpret Scripture. Yes, exactly.
Thank you.